It's a great pleasure to welcome you to Westminster Abbey on behalf of the Dean and Chapter to this One People Oration for the year 2018. The phrase One People was first coined by the Dean and Chapter in 1965 when, on the 28th of December 1965, they launched a year of One People. And they had a great service here on the 28th of December 1965 when all the ecumenical representatives came. And for the first time, the Roman Catholic Church was represented for the first time since the Reformation by a Monsignor. And there were various Greek Orthodox bishops and Free Church leaders. The entire royal family came on the 28th of December 1965. And then during the course of the year, incidentally, Ian Trethewen did the television broadcast. It was an amazing, you can still see it, I think. That launched a year where the Abbey focused almost all its attention on the idea of one people, bringing together all sorts of different groups through 1966, largely, until Christmas 1966. And ever since then, not every year, but most years, we've had a one people oration. So this is, of course, now part of Westminster Abbey Institute, which the Dean and Chapter founded in 2013, with the aim of revitalizing, or focusing on anyway, moral and spiritual values within our national life and beyond, especially in public life and service, working with our neighbors around Parliament Square. So the four institutions, the Palace of Westminster, Whitehall, the Supreme Court, and on this side of Parliament Square, the Abbey. So working with them and with others, such as the Metropolitan Police and the London District of the Army. And the Institute, therefore, concerns itself with issues of moral and spiritual courage and the compass of public servants as individuals and also public service institutions. So it's a particular pleasure in this 150th anniversary of the Royal Commonwealth Society to welcome the Secretary General of the Commonwealth as our One People orator this year. Baroness Patricia Scotland is, of course, enormously well known to us all, and you have her biography upon your seats, as I'm afraid you have mine as well, but that's quite trivial by comparison. We regard as hugely important the relationship between the Abbey and the Commonwealth. Every Commonwealth High Commissioner is welcome on their National Day or near it to read the second lesson. We pray for their country at Evensong, and they almost always bring a group of people from their High Commission, from their country as well. And that's a wonderful moment for us. And one of the great high spots of the Abbey year is Commonwealth Day on the second Monday in March, which is always supported by Her Majesty the Queen and in recent years by many senior members of the royal family as well. So we treasure our contact with the Commonwealth, seeing it as a force for good in a world where there is too much disagreement. The Institute's autumn program seeks to understand better what kind of people we need to be and what kind of institutions, therefore, we need to have if we're going to embrace the global challenges of the 21st century. And we're delighted that Baroness Scotland is here to inform and inspire us on this enormously important and perhaps to some degree intractable problem. So a very warm welcome indeed to Patricia Scotland.
Well, firstly, can I thank the Dean for that warm welcome and indeed all of you for being here. And say what an enormous privilege and pleasure it is for me to have been asked to give this oration. 1966, I think, can be remembered for two things. One, it was the last time that England won the World Cup. And secondly, that it was the 900th anniversary year of the consecration and dedication of Edward the Confessor, and hence this wonderful lecture series. But 65 years ago, at the coronation in 1953, this great abbey, filled to the sound of Psalm 100 in its metrical setting, being sung to a special new arrangement by Vaughan Williams. The opening words of the hymn seem a suitable exhortation with which to open this oration. It was all people that on earth do dwell. Sing to the Lord with cheerful voice. And the succeeding lines go on to suggest a suitably positive approach to embracing global challenge, because it said, him serve with mirth, his praise forth tell. Come ye before him and rejoice. While in the Commonwealth, we may account for only a third of all people that on earth do dwell, we can lay claim to a superb record of embracing global challenges and of adapting to change, maybe with mirth, certainly with far-sighted vision and goodwill. A supreme contributory factor in such a striking achievement has been the constancy and the exemplary dedication of Her Majesty the Queen, head of the Commonwealth, at whose coronation that hymn was sung. She made her solemn vows in this hallowed place, before God and to the people of the Commonwealth. The scenes and sounds were beamed to an unprecedented global audience, to a watching world. Since then, and under her gracious headship, through 7 decades of technological progress and social transformation, the Commonwealth has steadily grown in scope and in stature. By it, 1/3 of the population of the world are brought into a family relationship which speaks eloquently of both independence and interdependence, of nationhood, yet of supranational sisterhood and brotherhood. Our guiding genius has been to cooperate and belong together in a world that has been changed almost beyond recognition as we have moved through an era of decolonization and globalization and beyond. As the Queen put in her first Christmas broadcast in 1952, the Commonwealth is, and I have the temerity to quote her, a most potent force for good and one of the true unifying bonds in this torn world. Strikingly, in view of the prevailing attitudes at that time, in her Christmas broadcast from New Zealand in 1953, Her Majesty said, and these were the words, "The Commonwealth bears no resemblance to the empires of the past. It is an entirely new conception, built on the highest qualities of the spirit of man, friendship, loyalty, and the desire for freedom and peace. To that new conception, of an equal partnership of nations and races, I shall give myself heart and soul every day of my life. An equal partnership of nations and races was a bold, indeed for many, a controversial vision in 1953. And we need constantly to be reminded of the innovative and pioneering nature of what the Commonwealth is and what the Commonwealth does. As periods of migration and greater mobility of populations occurred from the 1960s onwards, both planned and unplanned, the Commonwealth's sense of being one people, a global family, has contributed immensely to the easing tensions which might otherwise have arisen or taken root. This often unacknowledged fact is something for which we should all pause and give thanks. So too for the fact that in the era when countries were achieving independence and defining their nationhood, we were determinedly a Commonwealth of Nations and have remained so. We work together where and when and in whatever ways we can, and yet there is no compulsion other than that of abiding by those values and principles which the governments and people of our member nations themselves adopt freely and willingly as the standards to which they themselves aspire and against which they consent to be measured and to be held accountable by their peers. These values and principles are drawn together in our Commonwealth Charter, signed by Her Majesty on Commonwealth Day 2013, which opens with the words, "We, the people of the Commonwealth." It is a stirring affirmation of unity and common purpose. Its headings and the wordings under them present a roll call of global challenges, which we embrace as the Commonwealth, and are able in the most remarkable and distinctive way to work on together as nations and collectively. Earlier this year, we marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He is honored as a martyr of the 20th century with a statue above the great west door of this building. Martin Luther King famously declared, "I have a dream." In the Commonwealth, we too have dreams. The vision of a common future that is fairer, more prosperous, more sustainable, and more secure. Not unfillable dreams, but realizable dreams, the aspiration and vision of our Commonwealth Charter. And fired by this vision, we work to make those dreams the new reality for each and every one of the 2.4 billion sisters and brothers in the 53 countries of the Commonwealth. And it's important for us to remember that 60% of that 2.4 billion population is under the age of 30. There is another statue just across the road from this building honoring one of the greatest sons of the Commonwealth, Nelson Mandela. And indeed, earlier this year, a memorial stone bearing his name and the words forgiveness and reconciliation was placed here in the nave of this Abbey Church. With sagacity to match his humility, Madiba observed that the anchor of all our dreams, my dreams, he says, and I'll quote him precisely, the anchor of all my dreams is the collective wisdom of mankind as a whole. Collective wisdom is our greatest Commonwealth asset. Indeed, as I said in my Commonwealth Day message this year, we draw wisdom and insights from secular streams of thought and from the many communities and traditions that are the sea of faith. We also draw wisdom and inspiration from business, from youth, from women, and from civil society. And each and all of these tributaries are adding from the glorious diversity of their hinterland to our vast Commonwealth ocean of knowledge and understanding. This practical grounding to all our collaboration means that collectively we are responsive to needs that, as well as drawing on wisdom and experience, we share wisdom and experience of what has worked well and also of what has not worked well. This accelerates progress and helps avoid wasting scarce resources on policies, programs, or projects which are less than optimal. And it's an economy of ideas and action in which all give and all gain. Most valuably, it enables us to scan the horizon from many vantage points and perspectives, alert to emerging threats, and on the lookout for fresh opportunities. And we take counsel together. We plan, we imagine, we innovate. And as a convoy on the high seas or a caravan in the desert, we draw protection from being together and we guard to make sure that none are left behind. These are not just poetic flights of fancy. They are practical realities from a globalized world. And the Commonwealth was made for this moment. It is indeed, as Her Majesty the Queen has said, the face of the future and the original World Wide Web. Our Commonwealth emphasis is on the multiple levels at which connection and collaboration can take place, and on the personal, the local and the regional, as much as the international. And alongside this, the Commonwealth has long been amongst the most powerful advocates and perhaps the most influential advocate for inclusiveness, for involvement by and for all. Because no global challenge is truly embraced unless it is embraced broadly and inclusively. So there are perhaps, and there perhaps has never been, a time when the positive dynamic of international connection has been more needed, whether among the advanced economies of the G20, a quarter of which belong to the Commonwealth, or within the broader and vastly more diverse context of all our Commonwealth members. So my ambition, working alongside our countries with shared vision and common purpose, is that we should put the wealth back into Commonwealth and the common back into wealth for the benefit and the well-being of each and every one of our 2.4 billion citizens. And I hope all of you will join me in this. We can each mobilize support for our Commonwealth in new ways through our personal contacts and professional networks. And that is how the Commonwealth makes progress and prospers. And despite what I hope I will show to be an impressively substantial and continuing record of cooperation, collaboration, and impact, the Commonwealth needs to be better resourced in order to take real advantage of the opportunities that are now available as the Commonwealth connection and as a result of all that has been done and all that has gone before. So perhaps it would be more accurate to describe it as not entirely valued, simply perhaps taken for granted or misunderstood through lack of appreciation. There continue to be some widespread misconceptions of what the Commonwealth is and what it does and what it isn't and shouldn't do. And the Commonwealth needs to be valued for what it is designed to be, and what it is configured to achieve. If it had not evolved, I believe it would now be impossible to create. So, what is the Commonwealth? The first Secretary General of the Commonwealth, Arnold Smith, a Canadian, said the Commonwealth is a living organism, not a political blueprint. It has developed over the years, not according to any written constitution or central plan, but as a product of a long series of courageous and sometimes very difficult decisions on immediate and practical issues by statesmen from many parts of the world, distinctly human in its manifestation and expression, but built largely on personal encounters and links. The Commonwealth connection brings us together as one people globally, a family tree writ large, with roots going deep and branches spreading wide. Our Commonwealth understanding is that increasingly local and national challenges are concerns for us all, because they are likely, in one way or another, to have an impact on us all and to affect our common future. Amongst the greatest strength of the Commonwealth is the manner in which networks for collaboration and progress flourish as a result of connections among the individual citizens and institutions of our member states. It was in 1964, at a meeting here in London, that the decision was made to create the role of the Secretary General of the Commonwealth and a secretariat to serve as a visible symbol of the spirit of cooperation and which animates the Commonwealth. At that same meeting, in a visionary and pioneering move, first suggested by President Kwame Nkrumah, I should tell you, I've flown in and I'm a bit tired, so I hope you'll forgive me. Of the Commonwealth Foundation was established alongside the Secretariat. It was given the mandate of encouraging the growth of Commonwealth-wide professional associations in order to cultivate and to nurture stronger links amongst the people of member countries and to deepen the distinctive character of the Commonwealth as a community of peoples as much as of governments. And that was an extraordinary thing, because the Commonwealth civil society extends far beyond the formally accredited Commonwealth organisations. It embraces the thousands of groups and associations and networks that connect people in and among our member countries. And the intergovernmental institutions and processes of the Commonwealth accorded ready access and involvement to civil society long before this became more generally accepted at high-level meetings. And the result is that still today, collaboration between governmental structures and the voluntary sector is far stronger and more integrated within the Commonwealth than is the case with many other international organizations. An example of the influence and the very significant contribution made by Commonwealth organizations is the process by which our Commonwealth Latimer House principles on the separation of powers came into being. The original proposal emanated from a small, informal ginger group of experts involved with Commonwealth organisations. Their ideas were taken up and developed more widely, including within the Commonwealth Secretariat. Ministerial buy-in then led to adoption of the principles by the Commonwealth heads of government. And this progression shows how, working together, we can build swiftly and productively on Commonwealth connection at multiple levels, often starting with the voluntary sector and in the voluntary sector. But most importantly, it demonstrates how Commonwealth convening power leads to global impact. And there are many, many other examples. Members of the Commonwealth Journalists Association and the Commonwealth Press Union Media Trust, together with representatives of other Commonwealth organisations, are currently working to develop a Commonwealth Declaration on the media and good governance. This would augment existing commitments and mechanisms and the Latimer House principles themselves, which speak of government's accountability being promoted by an independent and vibrant media, which is protected by the law in its freedom to report and comment upon public affairs. This is of particular contemporary importance, with the safety of journalists and campaigning social media activists is increasingly threatened and compromised. And codified values and principles are important tools for upholding freedoms and liberties in our member countries. I recently convened the 53rd meeting of the Commonwealth Ministerial Action Group, CMAG, as it's known, which was set up in 1995 by Commonwealth heads of government to deal with persistent and serious violators of the Commonwealth's shared principles. Since then, its mandate has been progressively strengthened by heads of government, and among the 8 circumstances that would trigger the group's interest and potential engagement with members, countries are the systemic denial of political space, such as through detention of political leaders or restriction of freedom of association, assembly, or expression, and significant restrictions on the media or civil society. Freedom of belief, with respect and understanding, is another pressing contemporary global challenge. And we have recently launched a new collaborative project called Faith in the Commonwealth. It is designed to promote social cohesion and deliver improved cross-cultural understanding and respect for diversity for those who wish to practice a religion and for those of no religious belief. Faith in the Commonwealth can help to transform communities in Commonwealth countries, and by doing so, deliver change both locally and globally, because within our kaleidoscopic diversity, we are able to find unity of purpose. We do this by overcoming the divisions of the past and by finding common ground on which we build on the good of positive inheritances we share. And the Commonwealth came to maturity in the form we know it today, during the period of struggles for self-determination, and when independence was being achieved by many of our nations. And after campaigns which had sometimes been bitter or violent, with raw political and communal division, newly sovereign countries were strengthening national identity and seizing with pride and enthusiasm the opportunities and responsibilities of self-government and destiny. This etched on our Commonwealth consciousness the importance of reconciliation and respect as preconditions for inclusiveness. So there was determination to build on those shared inheritances, often those that had not been given due respect or prominence, as well as those which had been more ascendant. As Pandit Nehru, the first post-independence Prime Minister of India, famously said, and I quote, "In this world, which is today sick and which has not recovered from so many wounds, it is necessary that we touch upon the world problems, not with passion and prejudice, but in a friendly way and with a touch of healing." The Commonwealth still brings that salve, that touch of healing to the world today. Earlier this year, I attended the Commonwealth Games in Australia. Many of you will have watched the great spectacle of sport on television. Some perhaps even have been there in person. There was a very important innovation at the Gold Coast 2018. These were the first Commonwealth Games to have a reconciliation action plan. It is based on respect, relationships, and opportunities, and is a direct result of the commitment to deliver legacy outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, the Indigenous inhabitants of Australia, and traditional custodians of the land. It was also the first Commonwealth Games to have equal contributors for men and for women, so equality at the heart. Reconciliation, respect, and relationships are all important factors in building trust and integrity. It takes a long time to build trust, yet it can be lost very quickly and then only painstakingly restored. Whether in sport, in the corporate world, in the professions, or in politics, we still see damaging examples of integrity being compromised, which impedes accountability and undermines open and honest governance. This is injurious to progress, it destroys confidence, and is inimical to our mutually supportive Commonwealth values of democracy and development. And while I was in Australia, I also participated in the Commonwealth Sports Ministers' meeting and spoke to the Commonwealth Games Federation General Assembly. And at those gatherings and in wider discussion and around the Commonwealth Games, there was a great deal of discussion on building integrity in sport. It's a hot topic, a global challenge. And the Commonwealth not only encourages engagement on such issues, it offers the means and the mechanisms for cooperation and involvement. And these respond to need and draw on experience in an extraordinarily broad range of contexts and deliver coordinated practical action to which all may give and from which all may gain. For it is by lighting one candle after another that the darkness can be overcome. And through the solidarity of support and mutual encouragement, that the weak are made stronger, the left behind catch up, and the vulnerable build resilience. Our Commonwealth approach is for all voices to be heard, and for all to have a seat at the table, the smaller or weaker, and those who so often are more severely affected by global crises, together and equally with the stronger and more resilient. Woven deeply into the fabric of the important global contributions to progress that have been made possible through our collaboration and conversation is the way in which Commonwealth meetings are conducted. Trust and goodwill are strengthened by our practice of making decisions by consensus, not by vote. This is a significant matter for the Commonwealth, as it is distinctive. National delegations do not arrive at Commonwealth ministerial meetings already having fixed an immovable position or deciding that they will simply vote or against a position. There are no votes. There is give and take. Ministers and heads of delegations and their officials have to listen carefully to the contributions of all. They have to accept the validity of positions other than their own, and they have to be ready to explain to others why they hold a particular view and present it in ways which will appeal to the countries from other regional settings and varying stages of economic and social development. Ground nearly always has to be given, and concessions by others are graciously accepted. And this means that there are no winners and no losers. Outcomes and agreement are all owned by all. And as a result, they are broadly applicable and inclusive. We reach decisions by consensus and find collective Commonwealth solutions in order to embrace global challenges. And our decisions and solutions are then often taken up more widely as blueprints where agreement has seemed elusive or progress unlikely. And this is because countries which are not members of the Commonwealth recognize that agreement reached by consensus among nations so diverse and geographically widespread as our members is likely to take into account global needs and concerns and to be broadly acceptable to all. For example, in 2009 at COP15 in Copenhagen, consensus was reached at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Trinidad and Tobago on the need to call for a multi-billion dollar annual global adaptation fund to support developing countries. This set the terms for the debate at the climate change conference, and the fund became one of the notable successes to emerge from Copenhagen when developed countries agreed to deliver $30 billion in fast start financing. Similarly, before COP21 in Paris, which opened immediately after the conclusion of the 2015 Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Malta, Commonwealth consensus was reached on the need to mobilize global and national efforts to hold the increase in global average temperatures below 2 or 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And this was agreed to be necessary in order to adapt to the adverse impacts of climate change and to achieve sustainable economic and technological transformation, both in mitigation and adaptation. And such actions carry forward a long and impressive narrative in which the Commonwealth has been right at the forefront of global action on climate change. It's significant that it was way back in 1989 when the Langkawi Declaration was made, which I'll come to in a little while, but that started, that was the gun, 27 years ago, and 3 years before the Rio Earth Summit of 1992, Commonwealth leaders signed the Langkawi Declaration on the environment, which for the first time collectively cited the greenhouse effect on one of the main environmental problems facing the world. The declaration recognised the threats posed to islands and low-lying coastal states by rising sea levels and other perils of climate change resulting from global warming. This record of engagement in tackling broad range of global challenges, or perhaps I should say embracing a broad range of global challenges, was continued at the outstandingly successful Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting here in London at Windsor earlier this year. There were important meetings of foreign ministers and other gatherings convened alongside the principal meeting, CHOGM, as it is more generally known. And the communique and declarations issued from that bear witness to the breadth of engagement, and their titles resound with promise. And I think it's important for us to remember that at the time that meeting took place, there had been no agreement at the G7, no agreement at the G20, and there was dissonance globally on so many issues. So it was extraordinary that 53 leaders from 6 different regions from right across the world came together as a Commonwealth of Nations and agreed on everything. Absolutely everything. And that Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting statement in September 2018, and also the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting communique entitled Towards a Common Future, brought about many things. The Commonwealth Blue Charter was adopted. The Commonwealth Cyber Declaration was issued. Heads also made an important declaration on Commonwealth connectivity agenda for trade and investment. They revised the Commonwealth guidelines for the conduct of election observations in member countries, and that too was adopted. And there were also statements and other outcomes from the associated gatherings for business, youth, women, and civil society. So let me say more about just some of the outcomes of CHOGM, because they will give an indication of how Commonwealth cooperation achieves positive global impact and how we embrace global challenge. Our 2018 trade review was presented at CHOGM. It shows that even though the Commonwealth is not constituted as a formal trading bloc, trade and investment among our members is strong and growing. When Commonwealth countries trade with one another, they enjoy a 19% cost advantage when measured against comparable country pairs. We call this the Commonwealth advantage. Our common language, our shared inheritances, and similar systems of regulation and administration based on common law bind us together, making transactions easier and bringing many efficiencies when we trade with one another. Our research shows that the common law inheritances of the Commonwealth, which prize the sanctity of contracts, plays a key part in explaining this Commonwealth trade advantage. A very significant new finding is that Commonwealth countries, on average, enforce commercial contracts far more swiftly, taking 20% less time compared to the world average. And I hope we will capitalize on this to make even more of our inbuilt affinities that we enjoy. So with world growth now on the rebound, after a massive slump following the global financial crisis a decade ago, we project that intra-Commonwealth trade should reach around $700 billion by 2020. And if the work that's now being undertaken to create the African Continental Free Trade Area and the WTO Trade Facilitation Agreement takes root, there's a realistic prospect that that might reach $1 trillion. Or even more, if we can capitalise on the common synergies which are clear in our joint work to implement the WTO Facilitation Agreement. This rising share of intra-Commonwealth trade underlines the growing significance of Commonwealth markets for many of our member countries. Our research finds that there are enormous untapped opportunities to boost intra-Commonwealth trade in goods, services, and the digital economy. And for example, we found that we can grow intra-Commonwealth merchandise exports by 5% if we reduce by 10% the red tape and the paperwork confronting exporters in daily transactions. And this would be a relatively simple, since 42 of our 49 WTO Commonwealth members have already ratified the WTO Trade Facilitation Agreement. And of course, sustaining growth depends on there being enabling conditions in the world economy. But with rising protectionism and sentiments and the backlash against globalization in many countries, and even talk about trade wars, the role of the Commonwealth becomes increasingly important as a positive influence for strengthening trade links across boundaries and building prosperity in which all can share. At CHOGM, our heads of government expressed strong support for the multilateral trading system and adopted 6-point Commonwealth connectivity agenda for trade and investment. The vision is of building on Commonwealth advantage to increase intra-Commonwealth trade to $2 trillion by 2030 and expand intra-Commonwealth investment. The fact that Commonwealth countries have similar regulatory systems offer ready opportunities for greater alignment, which would further contribute to reducing trade frictions. And the Commonwealth Connectivity Agenda recognises the importance of the multilateral trading system in ensuring the integration of small, vulnerable, and least developed countries and countries in sub-Saharan Africa, the Caribbean, and the Pacific into the world economy. The 6 points of the declaration are: first, physical connectivity, focusing on trade facilitation, best practice, and infrastructure development and trade information. Digital connectivity, focusing on supporting the development of national digital economies, improving regulatory frameworks and best practice on digital infrastructure. Business-to-business connectivity between the public and private sector for micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises, and to enhance the private sector role in performing and promoting the blue and green economy. Inclusive and sustainable trade, that's ensuring the economic empowerment of women, youth, is mainstreamed in all sectors. And a donor agreement for our Commonwealth Small States Trade Facility was signed during CHOGM with India, Malta, Mauritius, and Sri Lanka, providing generous financial support. And if we are to meet our sustainable development goals, we are going to have to build prosperity in our countries. And this innovative facility allows Commonwealth small states to access the finance that they need to develop trade and sustain economic and social development by encouraging international banks to make more finances available to them. And then there is the important Commonwealth Cyber Declaration. In this, our heads of government set out their shared vision for cyberspace, including the areas such as economic and social development and online rights, and all countries committed to take action to strengthen cyber systems by 2020. And the declaration is the most comprehensive and geographically diverse intergovernmental commitment to cybersecurity cooperation. It recognises that cyberspace boosts social economic development and facilitates a common space within which diversity and richness of Commonwealth identities can be expressed. However, cybercrime does not respect national boundaries, so we need international cooperation and a vision for how cyberspace should be governed. At the Commonwealth Secretariat, we are working with our member countries to strengthen their capacity to detect cybercrime and are providing technical assistance to member countries on building their cybersecurity capacity. And this, we hope, will really enhance the incident response capabilities and promote trust in cyberspace. But responding to another very pressing challenge, the heads of government agreed on a bold, coordinated push to protect the oceans from the effects of climate change, pollution, and overfishing. 31 of our 53 member states are small. Their landmark decision to adopt the Commonwealth Blue Charter will affect one-third of the world's national coastal waters, helping to sustain livelihoods and ecosystems globally. This builds on overwhelming support from member states at the UN Oceans Conference in New York last year, when I proposed it as a collaborative Commonwealth approach to action on ocean governance and conservation. It carries forward very powerfully the existing commitment in the Charter of the Commonwealth to ensure fair, equitable, inclusive, and sustainable approach is taken to ocean development and protection. But it also demonstrated how swiftly the Commonwealth can work, because the idea came up in June and 53 countries agreed it in April. I think it's probably the fastest international instrument there has almost ever been. So countries are stepping forward right now, and they stepped forward during CHOGM to lead on the priority action areas on the Blue Charter. Australia, Belize, and Mauritius will spearhead the protection and restoration of coral reefs. Fiji will champion climate change action for the oceans, including blue carbon sequestration by coastal vegetation and development of resilient low-carbon coastal cities. The United Kingdom and Vanuatu will lead on tackling ocean plastics, supported by the $60 million UK commitment to a Commonwealth Clean Ocean Alliance. Sri Lanka will initiate collaboration on mangrove restoration, and Cyprus will offer its experience and expertise on the sustainable development of aquaculture, and Kenya will pioneer the development of blue economic growth. And further action groups are likely to focus on topics such as maritime security, offshore emergency and response aquaculture. And really grave concern has been expressed that without urgent action to mitigate climate change, to reduce vulnerability and increase resilience, the impacts of climate change could push an additional 100 million people into poverty by 2030. So the heads recognise that temperature and sea level rise and other adverse impacts of climate change are a significant reality and risk to many of our vulnerable Commonwealth countries. They renewed their commitment under the Paris Agreement to keep the increase in global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and to pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And in their communique, heads also expressed their support for a range of innovative financial solutions, both public and private, and include disaster risk insurance to enhance adaptive capacity and boost resilience, noting the importance of the Commonwealth Climate Finance Access Hub, amongst other things, in supporting member states. And they called for consensus on the use of the vulnerability measures to target appropriate support for those member countries most affected by natural disasters, including extreme weather events dependent on need. And their record recognition that small states constituting over 60% of our membership, the Commonwealth has always been a strong advocate for the causes of small states and has consistently raised international awareness of their inherent vulnerabilities. So the Commonwealth's commitment to inclusiveness means we have special concerns for the difficulties and needs of our smaller countries and those with economies at stages of development which render them less resilient to the sudden economic shocks, whether these result from global market crises, extreme weather, or natural disasters. And as a recognized voice and champion of small states, we have long been at the forefront of the policy research and the global advocacy to build resilience and support sustainable development and economic growth. And we've all seen the reality. What happened last year was breathtakingly painful. It started with mudslides in Sierra Leone. Hundreds died. Desertification across Africa. Then we had floods through Asia. First Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India. And it moved on then throughout the Caribbean. Hurricanes, some of the biggest hurricanes we have ever seen. Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria, destroying many of the islands. And then we saw earthquakes move through the Pacific. And then even here in Europe, we had Hurricane Ophelia. Three died. So we know that this isn't just statistics. This is about lives. This is about people. And this is about urgency. And what have we seen this year? The floods in Kerala. I just came back from Bali, and we had the devastation in Indonesia. But as we sat in the finance minister's meeting, there was another quake. And many woke at 4 a.m. in the morning. And what did we discover? More people had died. So when we talk about this climatic change and the need to respond to it, it's real, it's human, and its potential devastation is heartbreaking. So this concentration by the Commonwealth on climate throughout all these years, I think, has been needed and is still needed. But it also means that we have to continue to champion some of the innovative and gender-responsive solutions to address some of the common challenges, such as inequality, the changing nature of work, and the persistent poverty. It reflects our Commonwealth understanding that when women and girls are given equal opportunities to succeed, they can be powerful agents of change, driving stronger economic growth, encouraging greater peace and cooperation, and improving the quality of life in their communities. So we can be proud of the commitment made in the 2018 CHOGM communique to implement legislation, policies, and programs which mainstream and promote gender equality and the empowerment of women and girls in all areas of social, economic, and political life. And these are examples of contemporary global challenges which the Commonwealth is well fitted to embrace and is embracing. The magnitude of the challenges is matched by the altitude of our ambition, and by what one external observer characterised as the special ability of the Commonwealth to bring soul to international affairs. And there is a special feeling of family in the closeness and the symbiotic nature of the relationships that ministers and their supporting officials enjoy with Commonwealth networks of practitioners and professionals active in their spheres of responsibility. The organic and human characteristics of the Commonwealth's growth and development brings immensely valuable goodwill and trust to our relationships and in the way we do business. That we are family, not foreign, is recognised by the fact that our member nations are represented to one another by high commissioners, not ambassadors. Having a common language makes it easy for us quickly to get down to brass tacks, and our shared sense of humour also adds immeasurably to our Commonwealth's ability to diffuse tension and also to understand nuance and to convey strongly held views or positions in ways which, although powerful, are not offensive or divisive. All these factors contribute to our collective Commonwealth genius for making progress by embracing global challenges. So let me conclude by recalling more words of the great champion of the Commonwealth, Nelson Mandela, the centenary of whose birth we mark this year. As a young man, he stood in the street outside this great Abbey Church, looking skywards, and dreamed of a better future. He said, and I quote him, "Vision without action is just a dream. Action without vision just passes the time. And vision with action can change the world." Madiba also declared, "The Commonwealth makes the world safe for diversity." So it is with vision and by action that we work as the Commonwealth to make our world safe for diversity. Together, we truly are making progress towards becoming one people and towards a common future. A future which is fairer, more prosperous, more sustainable, and more secure. Thank you.
Thank you enormously for such a wide-ranging and very detailed prospectus. We might just have a moment for a couple of questions. I'm myself wondering whether we think that the richer nations are as committed to the Commonwealth as the poorer nations. I'm conscious of the fact that our attention in this country has turned so much after the last 40 or so years to Europe. And I've often felt that the Commonwealth, the flag is being waved by the Queen and by the Abbey, but not by everyone else. Is that the case as you see it, or is there a common commitment emerging?
I think there has always been an appreciation of the Commonwealth, but I think there is now a reawakening. And part of that reawakening has been as a result of there being an answer as to what is the Commonwealth for? What does it do? What is its added value? And one of the reasons that we have perhaps concentrated on some of the aspects of trade and good governance is that we know that in order to fulfill the Sustainable Development Goals, which are actually are the 16 elements of our charter, we have to find ways of making our countries more prosperous. So I think there has been a reawakening, certainly in the last 2 or 3 years, a recommitment and a reassessment of the real value of the Commonwealth. But of course, we await a commensurate redoubling of the financial and other support which would give voice to that enhanced commitment.
Thank you very much. Now, there are some microphones around, I think. So if we've got one or two questions before we finish. Yes, there's one over here. That'll be the first. And then we might take two questions together if there's another question, and then allow Baroness Scotland a chance to answer. Any other person wish to... Anthony here. Oh, no, can we take you? Yes, in the white shirt there. So a gentleman here, and then just there. Yeah.
Good evening. My name is Amir Singh Pasrich. I'm from New Delhi. I'm particularly delighted with your words about climate change. And Baroness Scotland, I think we're very blessed to have you at the head of the Commonwealth for the reason that there's a fusion of law and Commonwealth values, which is difficult to unite. My question relates to exactly that. I think Commonwealth values include climate change, and somehow we need to cast a duty on ourselves, not only as Commonwealth citizens, but also for Commonwealth companies, towards changing the way we approach the environment, being more responsible, using less plastic, discharging less effluents, and doing things like that. I made a similar comment at the International Bar Association conference 4 days ago in Rome, and my point was the same, which is that, is there some way we can cast a duty on ourselves by making the rule of law twist itself into accommodating what used to be called natural law, a body of moral rules, to include the morality of bringing in duties for climate change, for environment? Thank you.
So we'll take the two questions together, and then Baroness Scotland to answer.
Hello, testing. Thank you very much for your very extensive description of the Commonwealth. David Spence is my name, from Vancouver Island, British Columbia, on the west coast of Canada. And I was wondering if you could say some more about the faith in the Commonwealth reference that you made, recognizing the diversity of religion and spirituality in the Commonwealth.
Well, firstly, if I can, I hope, give you good news in relation to our push for climate. Over the last 2 years in the Secretariat, we were working hard to see whether we couldn't create a more regenerative approach to climate, which would be a holistic response, which would make a difference on the world, on the ground. And one of the main ways of doing that is looking at how law operates and how we can help to inculcate into the legal framework the sorts of principles which would make our countries more climate resilient. So what we have worked on is a climate change toolkit. We've worked on it with the UN and other agencies to create framework legislative provisions which could be introduced into our countries to give more resilience to the delivering of the Paris Agreement. And that toolkit has been launched. It is being modelled and being piloted now by a number of our countries who are finding it increasingly helpful. So that's the first thing. And if you would be interested, please look at our website where we've created the Commonwealth hub, the innovation hub, which includes our common earth issues, but also the Office of Civil and Criminal Justice Reform. So we're making these models available and hoping they'll implement. But if you look at the Blue Charter was something that, frankly, I came up with because we had the values of our Commonwealth Charter. But the question was, how could we distill those values and apply them to what we needed to do for the oceans? And from that came a wealth of support from right across the Commonwealth, where all our members basically said, this is something we want to do. And so they agreed to it in June, and we were able to craft, the Secretariat was able to craft with our members a Commonwealth Blue Charter, which has now been endorsed. So it's a real example of what law and environment can do together. If I can come to faith in the Commonwealth, the reason that this project was brought together is because in our Commonwealth, we have every faith known to man and those of none at all. And yet the respect and the warmth, and actually people don't often use this, but what you find in our Commonwealth meetings is the love that there is between members of our Commonwealth from such various traditions is really an example. And so the project brought together young people in a number of different countries. We tried 4 countries, bringing individuals from all different faiths and those of none to participate and to work on projects. It has been one of the most successful pilots we've ever had, and we are looking for money now to continue it, to implement it in many other countries. And that led us to doing something quite extraordinary. We launched the Commonwealth Community Cricketing Cup, and the first people to play the match was the Pope's 11, the Vatican 11, who played with the Archbishop's 11 against a Commonwealth multi-religious team and those of none. We had everyone. We had Buddhists, Jains, Sikhs, Jewish people. We had, there was absolutely every religion in our country and certainly in our Commonwealth that we could find. And we had an atheist. And at the end of the match, he said maybe he was an agnostic.
Thank you very much. Well, I think we'll finish now. I just say that not everyone knows that the Pope has his own cricket team, but it's a marvellous thing. And almost all of them, apart from one captain who comes from Northumberland and works in Rome as a priest, most of them, I think, come from South Asia. So they're actually, it's all Commonwealth anyway, really, which is, of course, marvellous. Thank you enormously for your lecture and for your response to a couple of questions. There is a chance for everyone to have a further conversation with Baroness Scotland, because there is a glass of wine if you'd like to join us in the South Transept in a moment. But before we get there, please fill in your evaluation form. Please sign up to stay in connection. Please buy a book on your way out. I think that's it, Claire. It's lovely to see you all. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.